Hello there, and welcome to another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong, speaking to you from here in Istanbul. Many thanks for tuning in. In this podcast, we hear from authors of newly released books on Turkey and the region. Subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher, or Acast. Like the Facebook page, follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk. Check out show notes and links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com, and rate or review the podcast on whatever platform you listen on. Remember to consider joining as a member to help support Turkey Book Talk. Membership gives you various extra benefits and content. Paying members get access to a range of extra things, including full transcripts in both English and Turkish of every interview published on Turkey Book Talk in PDF form as soon as the episode is published. Members also receive transcripts of the entire Turkey Book Talk archive, which so far amounts to over 60 conversations. Most of these transcripts were previously published at the Hurriyet Daily News, but nowadays a Turkey Book Talk membership is the only way to access them. And that archive also includes a number of interviews not previously published on the podcast. Members also get access to a special 30% discount on Turkey Ottoman history books published by IB Taurus. IB Taurus have a terrific archive of titles, and they've made over 200 books from their Turkey Ottoman history series, both academic and general interest, available at cut price exclusive to Turkey Book Talk members through a special discount code. A number of IB Taurus authors have appeared on the podcast in the past, and there'll be more in the future, so becoming a member is a great way to get more acquainted with their work. If you do become a member, you'll have my sincere gratitude, and most importantly, you'll also be helping us to develop the podcast. If more people join in due course, we may end up being able to start publishing a new episode every week, up from the current one episode every 2 weeks. To become a member, just pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Turkey Book Talk's official Patreon account, which you can find a link to at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com, or by doing a quick Google search, or by looking at any of the other podcast pages. At present, we post new episodes every 2 weeks, so the monthly membership price is no more than $6. If we end up becoming able to publish a new episode every week, then that will go up to $12 monthly maximum. Of course, if you're feeling particularly generous and want to pledge more, then you'll certainly be more than welcome. But so long as you pledge $3 or above per episode, membership is entirely at your own discretion. Members only get charged when a new episode is published, so there are no prior commitments or strings attached. You'll be free to sign off whenever you want. But now let's get on with our latest episode. In it, we welcome Michael Provance, the author of the recent book, The Last Ottoman Generation and the Making of the Modern Middle East, published by Cambridge University Press. Over the past 4 years, the centenary of the First World War has prompted a new focus on that conflict's historical importance. In Europe, the war ushered in the modern age and precipitated the downfall of old regimes. But the conflict perhaps had an even more cataclysmic impact in the Middle East, leading to a crumbling of the regional order that was perhaps more sweeping and chaotic than anywhere else. The Last Ottoman Generation is a stimulating book focusing on continuities rather than ruptures. Much of it is taken up with biographies of various individuals who came of age in the final years of the Ottoman Empire, socialized into its ways of thinking and operating in the complex network of Ottoman imperial institutions that crumbled during the First World War and the years immediately afterward. The book, Michael Provance writes, focuses on the death of something old and evolving, and asks how did the old things, patterns, habits, cultures, ways of thinking, and possibilities affect what came after. I started by asking him to outline what prompted him to embark on the project in the first place.
The book is connected in a way to my first book, which was also my doctoral dissertation, which I researched in Damascus in the late 90s. And I went to Damascus as a graduate student, and my intention was to write about a peasant revolt, which turned out to be kind of a nationalist revolt. It was a revolt that took place in a southern region of Syria, Druze area. The people who had been involved in the revolt were mostly Ottoman war veterans. And I noticed that some of them, you know, once this revolt in Syria was crushed by the French army, they didn't stop. And as I looked more intently into these people's background, I realized that there was an entire strata of people who were involved in the Great War in the Ottoman army, and then continued to be involved in political struggles all over the region for the next, in some cases, the next 25 years. And so it seemed to me that the story of those people from the time of the armistice in 1918 until at least the end of the mandates in the late 30s was a good story and a way to understand the history of the region as it seemed to me they would have described it, which was a unified united place, undivided, unpartitioned, with one struggle against the partition and the colonization of the region. And that they linked what they were doing with what was happening in Anatolia, with the Turkish nationalist movement, as it came to be called. I don't call it that. I call it the Anatolian insurgency. And that all these things were part of the same story from their perspective. That seemed to me to be a way to get at the story and to try to understand it in a way that would make sense to the people who lived through it.
And over the last 4 years, really, you know, the whole centenary of the First World War, there's been this kind of renewed focus, really, on that conflict and the effects that it's had in Europe. But also, it seems that there's been a renewed appreciation of the effects in the Middle East. I mean, there's been scores of books written on the subject, taking various angles. Has anything in particular struck you about this 4 years of retrospection?
Well, I think that the notion that the Great War, that the First World War was a European experience, I think that's kind of demolished now. I mean, it's certainly, I'm living in France right now, so in France, the First World War was uniquely destructive and a searing experience for the French. But from a larger perspective, I think that we can say that the Great War probably was the conclusion to the Eastern question, the question that animated British and French and Great power diplomacy from at least the time of the Crimean War. It was really the main issue of European geopolitics. And so the Great War decided that and concluded it. And I think this was probably something that British, French, Russian, German statesmen understood. I'm sure that they understood it based on the documents of the time. So to put the Ottomans back in the Great War as a goal, as an objective, and as a place where the conflict played out, I think is an important result of most of these retrospectives.
Now, the book follows through with a kind of range of biographies, really, of key symbolic individuals, really, from what you call this last Ottoman generation. I wonder if at this point you could just introduce a couple, really, of key characters that you mention in the book who exemplify this broader point that you make throughout it of kind of Ottoman continuity, this idea that there's a generation who were socialized, essentially, into Ottoman ways of thinking and then found themselves in a kind of radically different world that emerged in the 1920s and beyond. I wonder if you could just kind of identify a couple of key characters who make this wider point.
Well, there's a number of people. I mean, in a way, we could say that Mustafa Kemal and the people who participated in establishing the Turkish Republic belong in this group too, of course. They passed through the same institutions and had the same experiences. But part of my goal was to write the Arabs back into Ottoman history, late Ottoman history, and to make the point that the Ottoman state was not a Turkish nationalist state, and that while people who maybe spoke Turkish at home and came from the region around Istanbul played a prominent role in the state, they weren't the only people, and that it was possible to become an elite Ottoman through Ottoman institutions, especially military schools, if you came from Bulgaria. We're talking about Muslims now, of course, for the most part, or Crete, or anywhere in what became Greece, or the Balkans, or Bosnia, or Albania, or Chechnya, for that matter, or Egypt. And certainly many, many thousands of Ottoman officers came from the Arab regions, from Syria and Iraq, and what is today Israel, Palestine, Jordan, and Lebanon. And so I wanted to put those people back in the story, because I thought that they had been excluded both by Turkish nationalist historiography, which didn't really admit the possibility that such people could have existed, and by Arab nationalist historiography, which made the argument, which I heard often in Syria, that we, the Arabs that is, suffered 400 years of Turkish occupation. And so the presence of really elite, privileged, cultured people who may have been born in Baghdad or Damascus or even places like Tripoli in Libya in the higher reaches of the Ottoman bureaucracy and military, I think, needed some explaining and some understanding. Among these people, the one I'm most interested in, and I'm still interested in, is Yasin al-Hashimi, who was probably the most formidable Arab politician of the interwar period, and was, I think, two, maybe three times the prime minister of Iraq, and during the course of the Great War was a major general and ended the war on the Palestine front, like Kemal did, except Yasin al-Hashimi, who, like Kemal, was from a lower middle class, modest family in Baghdad. He was born in Baghdad, and both of his other brothers were also Ottoman officers. Yasin al-Hashimi Hashemi was promoted through the ranks faster than Mustafa Kemal Pasha during the course of the war. So in other words, he started the war at a slightly lower rank and finished the war at the same rank. So a story like that is almost, it defies belief and really 100 years of historiography on both the Turkish nationalist and Arab nationalist stories. So Yassin ended the war as a major general. He was wounded and he fled to Damascus, where he became the chief of staff of Amir Faisal's Arab government in Damascus, and then was jailed by General Allenby, the British liberator of Jerusalem and the supreme commander, and then released, and then fled after the French invaded inland Syria and Faisal fled. And because he had advocated armed resistance against the French and the British in Syria and elsewhere so as to gain an independent state, like Mustafa Kemal was doing north of the armistice line. Because of that, Faisal didn't want him, and the French wouldn't admit him. He had to flee Damascus. He tried to rejoin the Ottoman army. Kemal said, no, sorry, we don't want you. You've waited too long. But of course, probably the real reason was that a similarly distinguished major general would not be a welcome collaborator to somebody who had designs on founding a new state and becoming the unquestioned leader. So he ended up in Baghdad, essentially begging Faisal for a job, which Faisal gave him. This is King Faisal of Iraq now. And then he did very well and was extremely successful. And like I say, was a very formidable, talented politician. And so he ended up within a couple of years being the prime minister. And the most popular politician in Iraq and probably in all of the mandate countries. Except in 1936, he was too successful. And I discovered that he was overthrown by the British government and exiled, forced to flee first to Damascus and then to Beirut, where he died under what I consider probably suspicious circumstances a few months later. So this is an interesting story, and it's a forgotten story. And, you know, he was a person who in every way was acculturated, prepared, similarly distinguished, and talented, like Mustafa Kemal Ataturk, but was stymied directly by the British government. Iraq was too important to allow someone like Yassin al-Hashemi to assert real independence of the country in the period immediately before the Second World War. So he's one, but there's other people too, like Fawzi Kawakci, the famous revolutionary who fought in Palestine in 1936, in Syria in 1925, and in Palestine in 1948 against the Haganah and the forces that eventually became the Israeli army. Fawzi was a less accomplished individual, both in the Ottoman army and after, than Yassin al-Hashemi. But he's an attractive revolutionary and a romantic figure, not always well-liked, I should say. So there's others, but these are two of my favorites, and they're certainly exemplary figures for this kind of post-Ottoman transnational revolutionary tendency.
There's a character that I mentioned in the review, and he's a very minor character, really, but he's somebody that you discovered as you were researching the book. It's this character called Leon Efendi Baos, if that's the right pronunciation. Now, he was born in Basra in southern Iraq, and he was a Greek Orthodox son of an Ottoman telegraph official. He was born at the end of the 19th century, and obviously his father was considered Greek, but then there was the Greek-Ottoman war over Crete, and in 1897 he had to take a kind of formal oath of Ottoman citizenship to keep his state employment. And then kind of fast forward into after the First World War in 1919, this Leon Efendi Baos found himself in this kind of entirely new state of Iraq. And obviously his citizenship was rather in flux. He wanted Greek citizenship, but he couldn't get it. Then he wanted his old Ottoman citizenship back, but that wasn't possible anymore. He then wanted to take Turkish citizenship, but he wasn't able to do that because he was in Basra in Iraq. And ultimately he was forced kind of against his will by the League of Nations High Commissioner to become an Arab citizen of Mandate Iraq. So looking back in retrospect, it's quite an amusing story of circumstance, but you can also see him as kind of a very symbolic exemplar of this kind of mixed, fluid identity that kind of all got sorted out in the years after the First World War.
Yeah, that's right. I'm glad you noticed him. And this, the story, by the way, and a lot of stories like it were things that I found in the League of Nations archives in Geneva. So the League of Nations was absolutely their last resort. And there were thousands of people who were stuck, by this partition. And they had been Ottoman officials. They were widows or orphans whose parents had pensions that were not being paid. There were people who had land that they couldn't get to because of new borders. And so this Leon Efendi guy, who was a lawyer, presumably an Ottoman state employee of some kind, you know, his situation was desperate. And so he wrote a bunch of letters, one after another, to the League of Nations, and they didn't know what to do with them, and they didn't really do anything with them. And eventually, I think there's a notation in the files that say, well, no further action can be taken. Additional letters will be thrown away. So it's a poignant story, and we know about the population exchanges between Greece and Turkey of all of these millions of Greek-speaking Muslims and Turkish-speaking Christians who suddenly became citizens of countries they had never visited or lived in before, usually against their will. And, you know, the passport politics, the things like Leon Efendi's situation, this afflicted people, sometimes famous people, who after the Treaty of Lausanne in 1923, you had to declare a state, a citizenship. And so thousands of former Ottoman Christians went to Syria because they felt that the Turkish Republic was going to be inhospitable to their prosperity and their rights. And people were moving around all over the place, but very few people voluntarily. So the tragedy of all of this just huge refugee flows and tremendous grievances about jobs and land and separation from families and children and mobilization and wartime injury and all of these kinds of human tragedies, they're pretty much forgotten. And I think they shouldn't be. The archives are, I mean, there's just thousands and thousands of petitions and letters like this in the files that nobody's really looked at.
In the book, you really do stress this point that a lot of the people that you study in this book are products really of the Ottoman military schools, and these were very important indeed in creating this last Ottoman generation. The focus, obviously, throughout the book is on kind of Arab elites introduced into the Ottoman Empire's institutions in its final decades. But of course, perhaps most notably, really from a Turkish perspective, at least Atatürk himself was one of the products of this late Ottoman military education. Just talk a little bit more broadly about the importance really of Ottoman military schools in shaping really decades that followed the collapse of the empire itself.
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a forgotten legacy. It's especially a forgotten legacy within the Arab countries. And yet, these schools are still all over the place, and they're still serving as schools in many cases. And when I lived in Damascus, I remember, you know, asking people, so do these places exist? I would read biographies and biographical dictionaries and memoirs, and people would write, I began my education in the Ottoman military middle school. And, you know, in reading the Arab nationalist historiography of Damascus or of any of the Arab capitals, such places didn't exist. They weren't part of the story. And so I asked people, and they said, oh yeah, sure, it's right over there. And in many cases, as I say, they're still schools. And the idea that if you were the son of a poor, ambitious family with no resources and no connections, that your best option to better yourself was to go to military school, that still exists. That's still part of the heritage of the region, and I think that's true both in Turkey and probably in all of the Arab states. So this is a direct legacy of the Ottoman fully subsidized state education system of the late 19th century. The idea of a subsidized, professionalized military state education system and cadet schools, it was something that all of the combatant states shared. And it also contributed to a militaristic, rather authoritarian outlook that contributed to the war itself. So scholars have studied this in Prussia and in France and to some degree in Great Britain, but the Ottoman state, it's not part of the story, most particularly in the Arab countries. So we haven't had the narrative in a way to contextualize or to understand this modernizing Ottoman story in relation to the story of modernity, militarism, and the emergence of the modern bureaucratic state generally. So that's a kind of a problem, and it also contributes to the tendency of historians and members of the public generally to think of Ottoman history and the history of the Middle East as if it's something different, as if it doesn't belong in the history of modern Europe. And this is a mistake. This is a lapse and a deficiency of a lot of our historiography. So military education was important. important. And of course, the legacies are all over the place. Like I say, the schools are still there, the structures are still there, the habits are still there. The idea that the military is a place for a poor, ambitious boy to get a good chance is still there. Military leaders are found all over the Middle East until today. And, you know, some of the things that they did in terms of modernizing the state are still around. There was a guy who was the first coup plotter in Syria after independence in 1949, was a person named Hosni Zaim, who, of course, had been an Ottoman officer, a fairly unsuccessful, low-ranking Ottoman officer. And he wasn't in power very long, but one of the first things he did was outlaw the tarbush, the fez, which is, you know, a fun fact, like Ataturk had done a couple decades before. But there's a story there, and there's a continuity, an institutional cultural continuity in the region that, as historians, we haven't kept track of. I think part of the reason is historians are usually not very militaristic. I'm not. And sometimes I was even a little embarrassed to be becoming kind of a military historian. You know, there's a certain reluctance to do that kind of work and to uncover those kinds of connections. But to understand the military as a social institution, I think is a pretty important job for historians.
And as you do that job, you really excavate some really remarkable details from these years of flux, really, after the collapse of the Ottoman state. And one of the interesting things you alluded to it a bit before is how the Anatolian resistance movement, led by Mustafa Kemal, at the time drew considerable interest in Syria, for one. People there saw it as this kind of continuation, really, of Ottoman resistance against Western imperialism. You write, quote, that events in Anatolia were widely known and greeted rapturously in Damascus, Jerusalem, and many other places. The atmosphere of ferment and excitement was inescapable. The press declared Mustafa Kemal a new savior of Islam and a hero of the Ottoman East. And of course, many people anticipated that the kind of Ottoman armies led by Mustafa Kemal to come and liberate them down in Syria, and began to kind of agitate for a renewed union with those resistance forces. And it's kind of striking to read that kind of stuff now, but this does kind of get to the point that you're trying to make in the book, which is trying to see things from the way that the generations themselves, the people who lived through this era, experienced them, and the kind of subsequent course of Turkish and Syrian nationalism at that time was still kind of in flux. It wasn't clear what would emerge. So there were all these kind of other possibilities that when you go back to the source and look at this kind of stuff, they do emerge from the sources. It's very interesting indeed to see them laid out like this.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. The thing I think that comes out from the sources is that the way that things turned out is completely contingent and accidental in most ways. You know, we know, for example, that the border between Syria and Turkey is the armistice line, which is the rail line, which was the last line of defense before the armistice, and that the Ottoman forces in northern Syria, just north of Aleppo, were organizing a defense to hold that line. And the armistice came before, and against the wishes of those people, they intended to do that. But the armistice came before they had a chance to actually defend those positions. So the border, which most people imagine came from some negotiation or something like that, and of course there were negotiations during the Treaty of Lausanne mostly, was really contingent and subject to the way the war happened to end. And, well, we could even say that the Ottoman army didn't really demobilize in Anatolia. And Anatolia was not under occupation. The French tried to occupy the east with something called the Armenian Legion, which was made up of Armenian volunteers. And the British tried to occupy the west with Greek expeditionary forces. And both governments, France and Britain, thought that they were going to be able to expand their occupation into the areas of Anatolia, based partly on Sykes-Picot and partly on wartime ambitions, to place client governments in control. And the reason they had to do that, of course, Britain and France, is because they didn't have any resources. They had no soldiers, and neither the British nor the French public would accept the idea that the armies wouldn't be demobilized and that the soldiers who had survived would not be coming home. So Clemenceau in Paris and Lloyd George in London wanted to keep their prizes. They wanted to keep the prizes of the war, but they couldn't be forthright about it. And And they couldn't tell people that the partition and dismemberment of the Ottoman Empire had been the objective of a war. And so they had to come up with client populations. And in both cases, first in Cilicia and in Western Anatolia, those plans failed. And then even before that happened, Kemal was able to make a separate ceasefire with the forces of the French military. And the terms of that ceasefire was that they would not, the Turkish resistance, the Turkish national movement, Kemal would not come to Syria, and that they would not support militarily their former compatriots in Syria. And in exchange for that, Kemal got all of the cached military hardware in Syria shipped to Anatolia by the French. This is a very little known historical fact. And the British government was outraged because, of course, those weapons were put on the still operational Ottoman railways, sent to Western Anatolia and used to defeat the Greek forces there and force the hand of Lloyd George, whose government subsequently fell because he overrode the wishes of his cabinet and tried to reinstitute hostilities against the Ottoman forces in Western Anatolia. So it's a kind of an unbelievable contingent story, this period. And the people in Syria did think, and the British government certainly thought, that Kemal and the Anatolian insurgency was coming south. And this is why when Allenby evacuated Syria in conformance with the deal that France and Britain had made, he didn't hand his positions over to the French. He just pulled out because he expected that the Ottoman army was going to retake the field and that he didn't want to be fighting the Ottoman army alongside France. So he said, we're going to solidify our position in Palestine, which included at the time Transjordan, because the Suez Canal was the important thing that he was worried about defending. So he said, we're pulling out. The French can come in here and do whatever they want, but we're not going to help them. Which was not exactly what he was ordered to do by Lloyd George, but it's what he did anyway, because he expected that the war over the Ottoman partition would continue. And in a way it did, but not with the direct assistance of Mustafa Kemal. But it's also the case, and important to point out, that the resistance that took place in Anatolia included thousands of people who were not Turkish, which is to say the Turkish national resistance included Ottoman military figures who had come from many, many places that did not comprise what eventually emerged as the Turkish Republic, including, of course, Kemal himself, who was born in Salonika. So it's a pretty messy story, actually. And I sketched it out, but I hope somebody else picks up the story. I mean, the Ottoman sources are pretty inaccessible, but I hope someday it becomes possible.
As I was reading the book, I kind of found myself inevitably contemplating some of the kind of intriguing counterfactuals, really, you know, on this subject. For example, like, what if Mustafa Kemal had united with the resistance in Aleppo? Or another one would be, what if the new Turkey included some more Arab-majority regions? I mean, presumably, as you were researching the book, you found yourself tempted to ponder some of these counterfactuals as well.
Yeah. Well, obviously, Kemal was very pragmatic. And I think that Kemal and the people around him decided that they needed to simplify their job as much as possible of gaining real independence for the Ottoman successor state. And considering that Syria and Iraq were actually under British and French occupation, they had to seek a way to avoid directly confronting the victorious Allied powers. And so making a separate deal with France was the way to do that. And probably plenty of people among the Ottoman command said, well, you know, Syria has been a lot of trouble and Iraq has been a lot of trouble and maybe we'll come back again later. There's pretty good evidence in other archival things that I've seen that in the end of the 30s, there were plenty of people in Ankara who wanted to maintain really close ties, and also in Baghdad and Damascus, really close ties with their former compatriots. And to the extent that, you know, it advanced political efforts generally, you know, there was always common cause to be made. But the Turks were independent and the Syrians and the Iraqis were really not. And so they were not in a position to negotiate or to offer things on the same footing. And then, of course, there's the situation that during the course of the Treaty of Lausanne in late 1922 and 1923, the British and the Kemalists, it was Ismet Inanu, negotiated the fate of Mosul. And Inanu was he came from the region, so he was interested in the place. And everybody knew that there was oil there. And they argued really forcefully. But it was also the case that the League of Nations had enforced a new kind of idea that states had to speak for nations. And so the Anatolian resistance had made the claim that they spoke for the Turkish nation. And so the British said, well, the people who live there are not Turks. And Inanu said, they can be Turks and not speak Turkish. Inanu said, we know very well who lives there because we've ruled the place for centuries. And the British said, well, you say you speak for the Turks and we're speaking for the Arabs and we say they're Arabs. And from the perspective of the League of Nations, this disingenuous argument carried the day. But the contour of claims making and legitimacy among states had changed, and the idea of an empire that could speak on behalf of a variety of people was something that the League of Nations and the Great War and the way that the partition was enacted, legitimated, and sold to the public in Europe made that kind of impossible. I mean, it's also the case that some Syrian and Palestinian political figures went to Lausanne and said, so, hey, you know, where does this leave us? Lausanne, of course, is the treaty that ended this state of real hostility between the Turkish, what became the Turkish Republic, and Britain, France, Greece. And it was the kind of the renegotiation of the post-war settlement with Turkey in a much stronger position than it had been during the armistice. But the Arabs, when they showed up, you know, they found out that nobody cared about them. And Inanu couldn't help them. And he had to do what he could to solidify the state in Anatolia. So it's a sad story and a kind of another forgotten story. But people who survived that war were not idealists or dreamers any longer. So the idea of fighting for principles or hoping for a better outcome that you could grab with force was not part of the repertoire any longer by 1918 or 1920, 1923.
And in the subsequent years, through the 1920s and 30s, you examine the mandate regimes in Syria and Iraq. These were kind of halfway houses, really. It wasn't direct rule by France and Britain, but it was a kind, like I say, it was a halfway house. And as I was reading, it kind of reinforced once again that the sense almost that this was almost worse, really, than outright colonialism, because there was this feeling that kind of local independence advocates were kind of denied the moral clarity, really, of a direct oppressor to campaign against. But at the same time, you know, those authorities, the British and French imperial authorities, had immense kind of power to commit very terrible crimes and also to on the more prosaic level to kind of just neglect the region and not really invest at all in any kind of proper institution building. It was in a way worse than direct imperialism, because there was this kind of neglect as well as indifference, in addition to the kind of crimes of imperialism that you detail in the book. I wonder if that was something that kind of chimed with you as you were doing the research, the idea that the mandates were this kind of uniquely bad way of organizing governance in Syria and Iraq.
No, I think that's right. I mean, I've spent a lot of time in the Mandate Archives, even before I got started in earnest in this book. And then I spent a lot of time in the League of Nations Archives. And I saw and read the ways that the functionaries of the Mandate talked about what they were doing and the kind of promises that they made, not to the populations in Syria and Lebanon and Iraq and so on, but the kind of promises that they made to the public in Britain and France and to the League of Nations. I mean, it seems to me that the World War was fought on some level to seize these territories. These were priorities. The British and French archives are quite clear about this, that these were the things, the end of the Eastern Question, the partition of the Ottoman realms, keeping the Russians out, keeping the Germans out of the Middle East, and dominating these regions for Britain and France were central war objectives. But to talk about them in a forthright way was publicly impossible, especially after the war, when the carnage had been so crushing and terrible, and the suffering of people in France and in Britain and in Germany was so terrible, and the political structures of all of the countries that had been involved in the war were shook to their foundations. And of course, we know that there was a revolution in Germany, there was a revolution in Russia, on some level there was a revolution in the Ottoman Empire, the Habsburg Empire ceased to exist. So the idea from the perspective of France, of Paris and London, that the political elites in those countries could do whatever they want, wanted, I don't think that existed. I think that they felt that they had to tread very carefully in order to avoid a revolutionary situation, in order to avoid mass protest on the part of not only the metropolitan public, but also the colonial public. And so the League of Nations and the idea of the civilizing mission and the mandate and the kind of language that characterized the settlement, which was idealistic, paternalistic, and based on a fiction of doing things for the people of the region in their own interests. All of this was a snow job. It was all nonsense. But because it was necessary to talk that way and to act that way and to institute institutions in the mandates that looked from the outside like they were representative, liberal, and benevolent, the actual policing and counterinsurgency and martial law regimes that were implanted were uniquely deceptive in a way that led to kind of political and cultural and legal defects that afflicted the mandatory state from the beginning, and I think continues to afflict the post-colonial state until today. If we look at the martial law codes that the Syrian government uses when it locks people up without charge, they have a colonial genealogy. They came from the mandate. And when we look at the legal structures that allow the Israeli army to bulldoze somebody's house because their child or cousin or nephew committed some crime or was alleged to commit a crime or was accused of committing a crime against the Israeli state, the law codes that make that legal come from the British mandate over Palestine. And when we think about the overarching executive power of supposed Republican governments like in Iraq and in Syria, this overarching executive is the same kind of position that the High Commissioner had during the mandates. So I think you're absolutely right. And in fact, people who lived through the period made this claim again and again. If you dominated us in a colonial regime, it would at least be more honest than this kind of deceptive, fake, and public relations-based constitutionalism that they were ruled with. So I think it's precisely the right question. And I think it's really the important legacy of the mandates in a general sense, and when we really peel back the layers, which I tried to do, in a specific sense, in a way that we can really put our fingers on, in a way that we can really go and say, they are able to do this to their citizens because this inheritance came directly from the mandate government, and the structural deceit was built into the mandate governments from the very beginning. So it's something that I really thought was important and that people should know about. If spending all those years in the mandate archives didn't cause me psychological damage, it's because my anger and fury over some of the things that I discovered there hasn't diminished at all.
Some of the paradoxical details that emerged were really kind of fascinating for me. You tease out really one particular kind of general trend in the 1920s that is today completely forgotten, really. And that is this kind of sense among many Arabs, prominent Arabs in the 1920s, who still felt affinity. And when you say affinity to the Ottoman state, what they interpreted as being the Ottoman state wasn't maybe what we imagine today. So you talk about Yasin al-Hashimi in Iraq still kind of expressing affinity with the Committee of Union and Progress, the Young Turks, because he saw that as being the trend that was that stood against the oppressions of Abdul Hamid II,
right.
Which today, from today's perspective, seems paradoxical, because when we're thinking about the Ottoman Empire, this is kind of contemporary Ottomanist line popular among some conservatives in Turkey today, where they kind of lionize Abdul Hamid II as the embodiment, right. really, of the Ottoman imperial spirit. But when al-Hashimi was looking back in the 1920s, he was contrasting in the Ottoman Empire, and by that he meant the Young Turk regime, positively with the mandate regimes that he was struggling against. So this perspective was radically different to what we might expect today. It just kind of goes to show just how kind of fickle and shifting things can be, really.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, it's funny because he wasn't the only one. Actually, a lot of people made that argument, and I noticed it a number of places. This very famous, also tragically assassinated, we don't know for sure that Yasin al-Hashimi was assassinated, but Dr. Abdurrahman Shabandar of Damascus was definitely assassinated when he came back from exile in the souks in Damascus in 1940. And when he was arguing against the tyranny and the authoritarian injustice of the mandate regime, he said, "We fought Abdul Hamid II, and we're going to fight these people too." So this argument that Abdelhamid represented a kind of a recent tyranny, which was successfully resisted and overthrown, was something that people came back to again and again. And it's pretty interesting. I wouldn't be surprised if contemporary Ottoman sources based in Istanbul didn't say the same thing. Because like I say, we have these two very prominent Arab Ottoman politicians, Shahbandar in Damascus and Yassin al-Hashmi in the 30s, making this argument that authoritarianism and tyranny can be resisted, and the struggle against Abdelhamid proved that that the people can fight successfully against tyranny. So, I mean, today, of course, Abdelhamid is taken by people as the last really strong Ottoman leader. But at the time, he was pretty unpopular. And I think that people who had been educated in the state system and aspired to play a role in politics as parliamentarians or high-ranking military officers or things like that, his unpopularity was quite universal. So it's an interesting lesson, and also the way that people continue to use history to prosecute contemporary battles and use historical figures as sticks to beat their political rivals today.
That was Michael Provance. Many thanks to him. Please do remember to consider supporting Turkey Book Talk by joining as a member. All you have to do is pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Patreon, which gives you access to transcripts in English and Turkish of every episode as it's published, as well as the entire Turkey Book Talk archive of over 60 conversations so far. Membership also gives you access to a special 30% discount on over 200 books on Turkey and Ottoman history published by IB Taurus. As a member, you'll be helping Turkey Book Talk keep the show on the road, developing further, and providing a bigger platform for our guests and their work. And if we get enough members, we may be able to start publishing a new episode every week. Find links to the Patreon account in order to sign up via all the Turkey Book Talk websites, and many thanks to all current members. It's very much appreciated. Also, do please rate or review Turkey Book Talk on whatever podcast platform you listen on. You can follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay fully updated with new episodes, and you can send any recommendations, feedback or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. But until the next episode of Turkey Book Talk in a couple of weeks, thank you very much for listening.